Today's Teisho is on Case 49 in Hekigandroku, Blue Cliff Records. Case 49 is entitled, Sancho's The Golden Carp is Out of the Net. Engo's introduction, 7 piercing and 8 breaking through, seizing the drums and capturing the banners, 100 barriers and 1,000 checkpoints, watching the front and guarding the rear, holding the tiger's head and securing its tail. Even all these are not comparable to the veteran master's ability. The ox head disappearing, the horse head appears. That also is not a wonder. Tell me, what do you do when a mind of transcendent experience comes? See the following. Main subject. Sancho said to Seppo, the golden carp is out of the net. Tell me, what will it feed on? Seppo said, when you got out of the net, I'll tell you. Sancho said, the renowned teacher of 1500 monks, you cannot even find one word to say about this matter? Seppo said, I am the chief abbot and I got much to do. Get out of here. The main subject doesn't say it, but get out of here. But that was the spirit. Secho's verse. The golden carp comes out of the net. Don't say it remains in the still water. It shakes the heavens and moves the earth, swinging its fins, lashing its tail. It blows like a whale, raising great waves. Then the thunder sounds, and a cool breeze comes. A cool breeze, yes. A cool breeze comes. Who in the whole universe knows this breeze? So here we are, fifth day. Who can't wait to go back home? Out of this jail. No? You guys want to stay another 2 days? You know, my teacher, our root teacher, Kurt Spellmeyer, he used to tell this story. I'm not necessarily sure it was really true, but that's how he told us. He said when he showed up at his first Zen retreat, Sasheen, a Zen teacher by the name Genki Takabayashi had just come in from Japan, and Seattle was up in an uproar, right? Everyone wanted to meditate with the Japanese teacher. So they had, usually Zen groups start small like ours, but in those times when teachers came directly from Japan, it was a big deal, like they were bringing authentic wisdom. So they had 40 people sign up for the first retreat, and none of them had any experience in sitting, okay? Including Kurt, including our teacher. And he, believe it or not, he said, that was such a hippie time. There was one guy sitting in the zendo with a pyramid on his head. Okay, so those were the times, really hippie, late 70s. And Kurt, you know, he had only done a few sits. He had no idea what he was getting into. So he started his first sit. He started it in full lotus, like pulled his legs up. And he says, by the second sit, it was half lotus. Third sit, it was like, you know, like how Caroline is sitting now. Fourth sit, he was on the floor. By the time his time for interview came, he was crawling on the floor. So when, you know, like, I mean, I have a similar version of it for myself. I had been practicing for 6 months. when I did my first sesshin. But I told you earlier in the sesshin, I went in the Dokusan room, third day of retreat. I just screamed for my dear life. I was like, I don't care what this enlightenment is. And you know, at that sesshin, unlike our sesshin, there was not even like screaming going on like you hear. Like no one was practicing Mu, or it hadn't happened till that third day. I can't remember now. So I wasn't aware of the custom. I hadn't read any stories. I just screamed out of sheer desperation. What I'm trying to say is that we, Imtiaz and I, are just so blessed that everyone here either has already had deep practice, or they were so sincere, so sincere. Like Lou came in last afternoon and I was concerned, like, how will she take 6, 7, 8 sits in a day? And I was so moved by their sincerity that it's like, even if you're hitting the wall, I'm gonna sit through this. Very inspiring. Very inspiring, satisfying, and just like pure joy to see that unfold. Like we couldn't have predicted. This could have been a sesshin where everyone was on floor, right? And that would have been okay too. That would have been okay too. It's just, it would have been different. So here we are, fifth day, when we were here, first, second, third day, we were saying we are climbing the mountain. It's taking an effort to reach a still place. But I'm hoping that today, yesterday, fourth day, fifth day, we have all touched more of that deep stillness. Yeah? Different traditions have different words for that stillness. And there are different shades to that stillness. But I have a feeling that especially in the morning sits, we really taste it very deeply, even if we are tired, even if we are a little sleepy. One thing that I wanted to say about the morning sit was, you know, I yelled, wake up, before I tell you why I'm saying what I'm saying during the talk, I want to tell you my intention. You know, there is one intention where you say, wake up, you lazy bum. You know, you're not going to get anything done in this life. Believe it or not, I was a nagging wife like that at one point. In our graduate years, there was one point I was capable of saying something like that to my beloved husband who's sitting here. But there is one spirit of saying, wake up, even if it sounds loud and crazy, is like, wake up! There is that beautiful moon, once in a lifetime moon, and it's coming up at dawn, and you are not still enough to watch it. So I didn't have clappers with me at the time. I just felt this restless energy moving through the zendo, and it came out of my mouth. And then later, Imtiaz told me, Kriti, that could have been harsh. Instead of whatever you meant, I mean, he didn't use so many words, it could have actually disturbed people. And it was like, oh gosh, that is totally possible. So if that happened, I am truly sorry, because I have learned the hard way that it is not just our intention that matters, but also the impact it has. The methods that worked in Tang Dynasty China, 9th century AD, will not work in 21st century AD because we are already a culture of haunted, guilt-ridden, ashamed people as a culture, right? So if someone in teacher's role overuses yelling and screaming in this culture, it can harm. So I was so glad Imtiaz pointed it out. At first I was like, oh dude, don't tell me. That's not what I meant, you know? I had that spousal reaction. And then I thought, he's right. So I'm so glad Imtiaz is always there to show me a mirror, right? Our perspectives might be different at different times, but it's good to have mirrors. Okay, so let's talk about this koan now. Everyone good? Everyone forgiven me? Okay. Golden carp is out of the net. Tell me, what will it feed on? So Sancho is an outstanding Zen teacher in himself, and he asks another Zen teacher, you know, they're playing around, horsing around. Golden carp is out of the net. Tell me, what will it feed on? Now, you know, Zen literature has a lot of analogies going on. There are a lot of symbolism, rich symbolism. And at first, when we read these stories, it might feel like, oh, they require a lot of intellectual understanding of Buddhist literature, Buddhist analogy. That's not really the case. The person in teacher's role usually helps us understand the complexities of literature and analogies, if any. But in the end, it is about our pure experience. This is not philosophy. This is not performance. This is about pure experience, at least the way we learned it from our teacher. So in this story, there is a little bit of analogy going on, and I'll explain it to you. Golden carp is out of the net. Golden carp, right? Carp fish, Ling must know, they are very common in China. You have a lot of carp, people have them in their ponds. Golden carp can be like a symbol of you, right? When we become golden with our sitting, with our stillness, and the golden carp is out of the net, in some way it's a symbol of saying golden carp is enlightened. You are enlightened. Okay? So after 4 or 5 days of sitting, we have reached a very still place or some layer of that, right? It could be deep, dark. It could be another version of it. I don't want to name any other versions because I know that folks are exploring different shades of mu here. So you've touched it and you are like ecstatic. You're like swimming. You're free. There is no net. There is no bondage. Okay? You have a feeling that you are free and there is no bondage. And so you're playing around. You're happy. You're almost arrogant with what you have found. Golden carp is out of the net. Tell me, what will it feed on now? Yeah? Okay. So where, if someone were to be working on this koan, this ancient Zen story, and there are, over 3,000 such stories in Zen literature that serve as these excellent, wild tools to break open our consciousness even deeper, right? Take it even deeper into the unconscious. Golden carp is out of the net. Tell me, what will it feed on? Seppo said, when you have gotten out of the net, I'll tell you. What do you think? You're out of the net? Okay. Sancho is not happy. He said, you are a renowned teacher of 1,500 monks and you can't even say one word about this matter. And Seppo, like, still won't entertain him. So I am the chief abbot. I got much to attend. Get out of here. Okay. So what's the conundrum here? What's the paradox? Right? Keep the playfulness and back and forth between these two teachers aside. What is the central paradox? So part of working with every koan, whenever you start working with it after mukon, not necessarily mukon itself, is that first task is you have to find the paradox, right? Each situation in our life, or given these stories, it has an inherent paradox which should boggle us. Like, we try really, really hard to figure it out with our discriminating thinking mind, and it's like the way Zen works is like, it's like, okay, try to figure it out with your thinking mind, but sooner or later you're gonna get exhausted, and that's when the big mind will take over and something deeper will emerge as a resolution of the paradox. Okay, so first step, find the paradox. Second step, let the deep voice, deep something emerge from you naturally without you trying to figure it out. So I cannot tell you the paradox, but it you can kind of, if you keep thinking about it, you know, golden carp is out of the net. At each out breath we keep saying golden carp. You will subconsciously start thinking, so who's the golden carp here, and what is the net? What is the net? What have I gotten out of, and where am I going now? Right? Or you can say, I have been through 5 days retreat, Zen retreat. I'm a little bit clearer. Where will I go now? Okay, appropriate for our fifth day when we are going down the mountain. And Seppo, the person who's responding, says, what are you even thinking about? First, get out of the net, then talk about what happens after getting out of the net. So there is some paradox here. Some paradox here that you can chew on, that you can find and then chew on. Okay. What I do want to say is that any notion of net, any notion of being bound by constraints, right? My imagination is that when all of us arrived here, first day, we all had these cobwebs and nets around us, right? I was thinking about my two conferences, my travel. Do I have visa? I have to go to Singapore for a conference. I have to go to Bangkok for a conference. My paper is not ready. There are scientists critiquing my work. And there was just like this underlying feverishness in my mind. Feverishness. Even though we've been practicing Zen for 18, 20 years now, it's like I came here with the feverishness, right? So that was a kind of the net, kind of the net. And when we are part of the net, when we are experiencing the netness of the life, bondages of the life, they not only bog us down. It's gonna kind of sound weird, so just stay with me as I go over this. They kind of give us a sense of incompleteness and also shame. Shame. Okay, what do I mean by that? You know, you know, some people, when they work on their breath or mu, they say, oh, I'm working with my breath, but I keep coming up with these walls inside me. Yeah? And these are, some people don't say it. They just say, oh, I'm having trouble working with my breath. My body is just stiff. But some people can name it. They can name it. And that's a big step in itself, that they see those walls. And these walls are usually, they are usually about our own self-criticism, our own inner nagging voices that we are not good enough. It might not still not be making sense, but what I'm trying to say is when we feel pressured by the universe, right? When we have all these deadlines, all these constraints, including tiredness, physical tiredness. You know, there are very few of us who say, I am Buddha and I get tired and I deserve sleep. Right? We say, oh my God, I am such a loser. I got tired. Some version of it. Do you know what I mean? The pressures of life. Pressures of life. And the way our culture is, where everyone is healthy, has an amazing yoga body, they can run 10 miles, they only need 3 hours of sleep, they can fly across continents and never have jet lag, right? All of that stuff. And here you are, you get tired? Oh my God, you must be, you know, like this whole culture is guilt and shame inducing. Does that make sense? So there are nets, there are these physical, psycho-spiritual nets, or you can call them walls, that we all have. And we have to see them, right? We have to see them for what they are. If we don't face them, we don't access the depth. Okay, so that's one point. Number two, when we have the sense, when we have the sense that we have gotten out of the net, let's see that some of you had deep experiences at this retreat where you felt some version of energy and stillness, chi, rise up in you. And for a few sits, few days, or maybe even right now, you feel freer of the nets, of the bondages. Okay? The koan is asking, what next? What next? We are Buddhas in spite of the net. And that realization takes a lifetime and we have to keep coming back to it. Yeah? And how exactly? How exactly are we Buddhas in spite of all the bondages and nets? Well, maybe that's the point of the koan, right? So koan is asking us to kind of work with that duality. But Zen doesn't just talk about everything is non-dual, everything is one. It asks us, specific koans ask us in very specific, unique ways, how exactly, like in your experience, in your direct experience, don't give me philosophy that all is one, okay? In your direct experience, like some people say, oh, if I breathe in XYZ way, I feel heat in my body or something like that. That's direct experience. That's not saying, oh, if I breathe like this, there is chi. I don't want to hear the word chi, right? What is the direct experience? How exactly is that one for you, right? So I've actually already said too much. I will not work with this koan with any one of you. But there is still something, right, that you have to tell your unique experience. I've probably explained the paradox. How exactly are you Buddha with the net? with all your bondages and walls. You know, everyone has heard of Avalokiteshvara. Avalokiteshvara is the male version of Guanyin. We have Guanyin statue sitting outside. I know some of you are inspired by this statue. Avalokiteshvara, the Indian version of God of Compassion. One version of Avalokiteshvara has 1,000 hands. There is a beautiful dance choreographed on Avalokiteshvara. I always have that visual in my mind. And he has long ears. And you know what they say? They say Avalokiteshvara has long ears because he hears all the cries in the world. Anyone in pain, the pain can be heard by Avalokiteshvara. And Avalokiteshvara has Sahastrabhuja, 1,000 arms, right? And so he helps everyone with those hands, right? He can help at least 1,000 people, right? So how does he do it? How does he do it? And then there is an answer to this in Zen literature also. And they say Avalokiteshvara helps them in the same spirit as the spirit he has when he is sleeping and he is adjusting his pillow at night. You know how we adjust our pillow at night? So naturally. No thought given. It flows out of us. Right? I'm amazed. Like, I sometimes Imtiaz adjusts many pillows at night. I have to tell you. I won't give away too many secrets. But I'm always amazed. Like, how is he keeps adjusting all these pillows? It's just like, and he keeps sleeping through it, right? The point is, it's very natural to him. I only barely need one pillow. Sometimes I just don't even need. But he has several pillows and he's like constantly doing some adjustment there. The point is, it is possible. I am not always in that state. Sometimes when I help people, I am kind of gritting my, I'm like, my nerves are tense and I am agitated and it's not flowing out naturally. It's like I should do it and I do it, right? But after days of sitting, many days of sitting, my mindset is like, it flows naturally, like adjusting the pillow at night, like Imtiaz adjusting the pillow at night. And that too happens in spite of all the nets. Buddhas don't exist without nets. How exactly? You have to tell me from your experience. There's one thing that Caroline pointed out yesterday, and it was like, it's been a long-standing con for me. You know, yesterday we were talking about how we do our practice moment by moment, and then she said something, I don't remember her exact phrase, that we have to display same kind of practice off the cushion when we go out into the world, moment by moment. And I kind of questioned her and I said, but what about history? Activism or structural activism, where we're really trying to change things in the world, that requires knowledge of history, right? That requires knowledge of history. And sometimes you, moment by moment work, we only go so far because you see a beggar, you feel compassion arise in you at that moment, and you buy them a drink or you buy them a meal, right? Happens in streets of Manhattan all the time. I worked in Manhattan for close to 3 years. Whenever I went to office, I could see people buying people on the street meals. Okay, you feel compassion in the moment, you do it. Okay. But what about the question, why are there beggars at all? Right? There's another very famous, it's not actually very famous, but one of my friends, Adam Lobel from Shambhala tradition, he's a good big proponent of eco-dharma. He says there was a big oil spill in Gulf. I can't seem to remember the year now. Was it 2008, 9, something like that. There was a very huge spill. People died. And all the dolphins and fish, birds, sea life, seagulls, they were drenched in dirty, dark oil. Dirty, dark oil. And you know, a lot of people of faith from all traditions, Christians, Jews, Hindus, people went there, they took their detergents and things like that, and they will pick up one bird and clean the oil off and then release them into clean waters. Okay? Then pick up another dolphin, baby dolphin, so cute, their hearts are breaking, of course, clean it up, release it in the clean waters. Okay? You see where I'm going with this? And then he said, what we people of faith don't do enough is to ask, why are there oil spills in the first place? Why do we have a system where we keep spilling oil? Right? So this was my question to Caroline, and that, and I've kind of holden fast to this. It's like, you know, this moment-to-moment thing is just not enough. But yesterday, after she spoke, and I still can't remember her exact words, but there was a conviction in her voice that made me probe this further, and I realized she's right. Because, I mean, even with our sitting, we hear all these talks, we understand the trajectory, we understand the purpose of sitting, but then when it comes to actually making the choice on the cushion, that should I move or should I stay focused on my hara, that courage is displayed in the moment. The practice is in the moment, right? What I'm trying to say is, we need history, absolutely. We need to study systemic causes and conditions of Gulf oil spill and poverty and animal abuse and everything. But that's like studying Buddhism, kind of listening to the talks and kind of getting ourselves inspired and clarifying our intention. But when it actually comes to practice, where we have to display our courage and clarity, that can only happen moment to moment. And we have to keep making that choice again and again, just like on the cushion. It's like, my legs are tired now. Do I uncross moment one? No. I am inspired by my teacher's talk on this, or, you know, D.T. Suzuki's book on this. I have faith that sitting through this will help me face my walls and nets. Okay, so I sit through it, and then moment number two, I make the same choice again. Right, which also requires courage and clarity. Okay, then moment number three, same choice again. What I'm trying to say here is that we need both. I kind of semi-resolved this historical history versus moment koan that I have held. So thank you, Caroline. Not to say that, I mean, they're both important. Of course, they're both important. So all of this to say, we are in day 5. Only a few more hours remain. We will break for lunch. We will help pack. I really ask that we maintain the graciousness and stillness as we pack up. I have seen retreats, gone through retreats where people are very quiet during retreat, and then when the time for transition comes, it's like a madhouse. It's like, I can't wait to get out of this jail. And all my suppressed energy is going to come out. We'll watch that. And then we'll have one last quick dokusan. By quick, I mean we will not have more than 5 minutes. I might even ring a bell on you if you have a lot to say. I might not have the time, but we want to just do a quick round, just last check-in, and then we'll do our closing circle. In our closing circle, and you can work on this with half your attention, because half your attention, I would still ask, be on your hara. With other half of your attention, you can consider the question, how am I going to serve all beings? Not just myself, not just my family, but all beings, using my spiritual practice. That sounds like a tall order and impossible. Maybe I should simplify it. How will I be of service in a way that is aligned with my spiritual practice? And more important than that is the question, how will we help each other get there? And that is another huge question, right? Because usually we attend retreats and then we go away to our respective homes, and we barely end up talking to each other unless we live in a neighborhood. Kind of open-ended, and as I'm saying these, I'm realizing they are too big. Maybe we can take a bite off the big question. So I'll think some more, but I wanted to mention this question now so that we are not coming up with very, very shallow answers when we bring up this question in the afternoon circle. The point is, Caroline talked about this yesterday. I talked about this. There is madness unfolding in our world. We are eating ourselves up. Right, our culture is eating itself up. It's destroying soil, water, air, just about everything we depend on for life. And we are harming our fellow brothers and sisters across generations, across species, across space-time in the process. What is going to be our role in making a change away from this madness, given who we are? Yeah? How will we align that with our spiritual practice? So, very big question. But I invite you to think about it as if that was a mini koan. It's not in any of the koan books, because these books were written at the time of Tang Dynasty, yeah? 9th century. But if someone were to be writing koans now, that should be it, right? I think some version of it. Not in so many words. Cons are usually terse, but something like that. And one very last thing. When we touch stillness, when we touch any layer of mu, we have only tasted one side of it. You know, when we hear these phrases, we recite Heart Sutra, right? We recite its English version in the afternoon. If you have not read it yet, it goes something like, a state of enlightenment. Give me a second. O Shariputra, remember Dharma is fundamentally Shunyata. Shunyata is a word, a Sanskrit word that means emptiness, right? That translation itself is very incomplete and faulty, but it says, goes on to say, no birth, no death, no thing is defiled, nothing is pure. This doesn't increase, doesn't decrease. No form, no feeling, no thought, no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind. You see what? No, nothing, 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 zero, 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 zero. You might feel like it's talking about something that is dead. And that cannot be, that is not my understanding of Buddhism. That zeroness, that emptiness is multidimensional. This sutra only talks about one dimension of what we call Buddhist enlightenment, right? That emptiness is pregnant, pregnant. That emptiness is alive. That emptiness is doorway to many different things. That emptiness is intelligent, deeply intelligent. You know there were people at this session, they were telling me story. I don't like to ascribe names to any story without taking permission of the people, but so I will not take their name, and I hope they are okay with me sharing this story. They said they got in touch with a friend recently, and a school friend, and they've just been having casual conversation over the phone and things like that. But this person said, when I was having my deep sits, it came over to me how lonely my friend is. You know, this might feel like, okay, it's a coincidence that you realize someone else's sadness. Not so, not so. It's that accessing that deep emptiness that gives us access to very intelligent empathy. Very intelligent empathy. I am not usually a very intuitive person. I can be very lost in my own little world. After retreats, it's not just once or twice. After retreats, I find myself dreaming of people who need my help. I pick up the phone and I call them. And it's like, thank God. So very intelligent emptiness, very intelligent. This, you know, we can get kind of sidetracked because this Heart Sutra is described as the best description of enlightenment in Zen literature, but it's only describing one aspect of it. Only one aspect of it. Okay. I have gone on a little longer, but I wanted to address these things that come up in the interview room. I don't know when I will have chance to connect with everyone again, but I so hope that our next few hours together would be alive. possessed by Mu, and we will all be ready to face our nets and walls in the next few hours and then beyond the mountain, right? When we descend and get back to the craziness, the madness, how will all of us be Buddhas in the midst of the net? That's the question. That's the question.
Show job.